Okay, you make the speech.
May it please the court, my name is Erin L. Blanche, formerly Erin L. Hutnick, and I represent the appellant Donald Gibson, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The two precedential cases that have value in this instant case is McLeod against Commonwealth and Bell against Commonwealth. The holdings of these cases by this court is significant in Mr. Gibson's case for two reasons. The first reason is that the facts and circumstances of McLeod and Mr. McLeod and Mr. Bell were different, as Mr. Bell was in the annual review stage and Mr. McLeod was in the initial civil commitment proceeding stage. Because the statutory interpretation of the relevant section of 37.2, and you'll notice that the legislature is not explicitly stated burden, not for the second stage of the trial or for the annual review proceeding. So we rely on the cases that have already been decided by this court. McLeod holds unequivocally that the burden of proving that there is no suitable, less restrictive alternative to involuntary confinement rests with the Commonwealth and cannot be shifted to the prisoner. And that second reason that the holdings in this case are so significant is that the interpretation of the statute should comport with the due process. In Hood v. Commonwealth, which is another Sexual Violence Predator Act case, this court quoted the U.S. Supreme Court to remind us that the commitment to a mental hospital produces a massive curtailment of liberty, and the consequences of that require due process protection. And that applies to the sexually violent predator commitment proceedings. With this in mind, as we look to Code 37.2-908 D&E, there are two simple but critical phrases used by the legislature, and it's the same phrase, it's just used twice, when determining the process of whether a person is securely confined or conditionally released, and that is the term continue the trial.
Counsel, let me ask you a question. I don't mean to interrupt you, but I'm going to sort of jump ahead a little bit. McLeod and the other case seem to be inconsistent. Is that right? Just go along with me, okay? Okay. The one way to reconcile them is to have a different procedure for the first time you're being declared an habitual offender and deciding whether you should be committed and on a review. Is that one way to reconcile them?
Yes, Your Honor.
And wouldn't the language of, this is a friendly question, by the way, 37.2-908D, which it talks about a person remaining, a violent predator remaining in the custody of the commissioner. Doesn't that suggest the position that you were arguing?
Yes, Your Honor. It's a very big difference from remaining in than the initial commitment.
So your point is it's okay for you think it's appropriate for the Commonwealth to have the burden of proof on the initial proceeding, because once we're through with the determination of a sexually violent predator, then the next step is where that person is going to be, either involuntarily committed or released on conditions. And the burden should still be on the Commonwealth, but perhaps it should shift over to the respondent when he's coming back for review, because he's already been committed.
Correct. And I think under the statutes, as I just pointed out, 910, as well as 911, which allows a committed person to petition at any time that's not part of the annual review proceedings for commitment, or the commissioner to petition for conditional release, somebody that's been committed. The statute allows for that. I think that also supports that view as well, that the annual rephrase is more of a review, as it's titled, to determine what factors that the court has already considered in the first initial trial has changed or has adjusted, whether there's a job or whether there's progress of treatment, all the time.
Let me ask you one additional question. This is slightly different. It changed the case a little bit. One of the things that troubles me about the statute is the way that it takes place. Once the person has been declared a sexually violent predator by the jury, then the judge has got two choices. The judge can, on his or her own, determine that the person shall be committed or continue the trial for not less than 45 days or more than 60 days to have this other information. What does that do to a burden of proof? Does that do anything at all?
Well, Your Honor, I think that Mr. Gibson, I don't think, has to concede that that's a constitutional provision, that aspect comports with due process. But I think even if that were the case, the second, that part of the stage that you described is part and parcel of the second stage of the trial. And all stages of the trial, including that little preliminary determination, as well as the next part, where they're receiving additional the plan and testimony by Mr. Gibson's family members, by parole officer, by his who would be supervising him and treatment providers, that would be part of the clear and convincing standard that the government needs to meet throughout the
process. So even if the judge decided that he or she was going to go ahead and commit the person, basically after the sexually violent predator determination, it would still be the same burden of proof.
Yes, Your Honor.
We have to weigh it with the Commonwealth's burden of proof.
And I think at that point, the respondent still has the ability to present evidence. Maybe there's not a plan because the court has decided I'm not going to look into a plan developed by the commissioner. I think that's what's limited to that first distinction. But it's all part of the same clear and convincing standard, because none of that evidence towards what Mr. Gibson's responsibilities, what his monitors would be, what controls would be, that affect his danger to the community, which is why we have these civil commitment statutes. None of those are considered before there's evidence presented.
Let me ask you this final question, and I'll let my colleagues ask some questions. If we agree with you on the statutory construction, we don't need to get to the due process.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
I guess I'm trying to understand practically how the statute can work the way you're talking about it working. Because when an individual is found to be a violent sexual predator, it says that the jury has determined, because of mental abnormality or personality disorder, that the individual finds it difficult to control his predatory behavior, which makes him likely to engage in sexually violent acts. So the jury has found that this person is likely to engage in sexually violent acts. And the statute gives the judge two choices. The judge can commit the person, or the judge can conditionally release the person. Right? I mean, those it's like it's binary. It's one or two. You can conditionally release them, or you can commit them. Now, you say the burden of proof is upon the Commonwealth to prove that there's no less restrictive alternative to commitment. What if the Commonwealth completely fails in doing that? It completely just fails. They just don't do it. They say, Judge, we got no evidence on that whatsoever. And there's no evidence produced to prove that the court can satisfy 37.2-912 concerning conditionally releasing the defendant. What can the court do at that point in time other than commit the defendant?
Well, I think the distinction in this case is that if there had been, if the court had taken the position that there was allowed to be evidence presented in the first phase of the trial about Mr. Gibson's controls that he was going to have, that was presented in the second phase of the trial, that would be evidence in the record that the judge could apply to 908D. Because you'll notice in 908D some of the considerations.
Well, let's keep things exactly the way they are. None of that was presented in the first trial. And the court says, you know what, I don't have enough evidence to determine whether I do A or B, whether I commit this person or whether I conditionally release them, and we're going to continue this, just like what happened here. And say, for instance, the court had called on the Commonwealth, and this is, and told the Commonwealth, you have the burden of proof, and the Commonwealth says, we don't have any evidence. What does the judge do then?
Well, Your Honor, I think that would violate Mr. Gibson's right to present evidence.
No, he can present it. Commonwealth said the burden is on us. We don't have any evidence, Judge. Do what you got to do to us. We don't have any evidence to put on. I would imagine he's going to turn to Mr. Gibson and say, Mr. Gibson, you have an opportunity to be heard. You put on your evidence.
And in that case, I think Mr. Gibson would want to put on evidence. I don't think he has to. I think
no, he doesn't have to.
Right.
And but he would want to, wouldn't he?
Because I think the court can then go back to what it's learned at the first phase of the trial and limit their findings in 908D. Because 908D, for that first determination whether they're going to continue the trial or immediately commit the defendant right there. 908D lists, I think it's 1 through 8 factors that they can consider to make that determination. And there's a limited number of factors that are presented in the first phase. The court can use those first phase.
I guess I don't understand what that has to do with what we're talking about. Because we're saying that there was no evidence in that first phase at all, that those factors couldn't be determined by the judge.
I guess I'm maybe misunderstanding your question. Is there was a first phase where evidence was presented, where an expert testified and gave actuarial findings, but then in the second phase, there's nothing presented. Is that the court's question?
Right.
Right. And so there are things that were presented in the first phase, such as actuarial tests.
Well, just like here. Exactly. We're talking about your case.
Right. They're right. Just like here. There was evidence presented by the Commonwealth in the first phase that would go to this. Some of it would go to the findings in the second phase.
Are you saying that satisfies the Commonwealth's prima facie case that they have to put on?
I would certainly argue it doesn't, but I think that the court could take that into consideration based on specific factors.
And if that is in fact the case, and the court says that does not carry the Commonwealth's burden, then what happens? I mean, you're saying that the Commonwealth has the burden, and I'm saying, okay, we'll say they presented the evidence in the first part, and the court says, it doesn't carry your burden. What happens?
Well, I think he's then conditionally released if the court does not.
Well, then how can he be conditionally released when 37.2-912 says any time the court considers the respondent's need for secure inpatient treatment pursuant to this chapter, it shall place the respondent on conditional release if it finds, and then it lists four things. And the court says, I can't find those four things either. They're not here because nobody's presented them to me. So I've got a sexually violent predator. I've got no evidence that they should be conditionally released. I think the judge has got to commit that person. Why wouldn't he?
And Your Honor, I think he...
If 912 cannot be satisfied, why wouldn't the judge have to commit the person?
Well, I think if 912 cannot be satisfied based on the evidence that the court had before it in the first trial, then yes, they should commit him. But if that were the case, then there should be evidence admitted in the first trial by Mr. Gibson to go to those factors, which was totally taken out of the jury.
Well, remember, we're at the second phase of the trial, so Mr. Gibson can put on whatever he wants to.
Correct.
But what if Mr. Gibson's evidence doesn't satisfy 912? The Commonwealth has put on their case, and you say they have the burden, they failed in that. You let Mr. Gibson put on whatever he wants to put on, and he's failed to prove that there's a conditional release plan that is acceptable under 912. What happens to Mr. Gibson?
Well, I think Mr. Gibson's evidence would go towards that, but I don't think he has the burden of proof, of persuasion by clear and convincing evidence.
Does he have the burden of... Does the evidence now, the burden now shift him to present evidence? Is that what happens?
Obviously, he needs to present evidence, not persuade beyond clear and convincing evidence.
Okay. Counsel, I think Justice Millett may have cut through the confusion just now. Obviously, we have to look at McLeod and Bell and determine how to meld the two. We have to look at the original trial and the annual review and figure out how they work together. But I think we have been conflating burden of persuasion with burden of production. In the original trial, the Commonwealth always bears the burden of persuasion, both in terms of is he or is he not a sexually violent predator, and should he be confined. In the original phase of that trial, the evidence that's produced is, in all likelihood, going to speak to both of those issues. The evidence that's produced in the original phase is also going to go towards satisfying the confinement factors. But in the second phase, the Commonwealth, to the extent it may not have met... In the second phase, the Commonwealth still has the burden of coming forward with any evidence supporting confinement that wasn't brought forward at the first phase. And likewise, Mr. Gibson, or the individual found to be a sexually violent predator, has the burden of coming forward, of producing evidence showing that there is a less restrictive alternative. But at the end of the day, at the end of the second phase,
the burden of persuasion has never left the Commonwealth. Would you agree with that?
That is exactly what I would agree. I would say that Mr. Gibson does have the opportunity, the burden of production, I think the chance to show, which he did in this case, things in the second phase that weren't in the first.
And if he doesn't show anything, if he puts on no evidence of less restrictive alternative, then in all likelihood, looking at the real trial world out there, the evidence that the Commonwealth put on at the first phase will speak to the factors the judge has to analyze during the second phase. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, that is a fair statement.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Susan Barr, and I represent the appellee, the Commonwealth of Virginia. I think it's clear from counsel's argument that the issue here is the proper allocation of the burden of proof on conditional release under Virginia Code 37.2912A. At the trial level, the court found that the respondent has the burden to prove that he meets all four of the criteria for conditional release under 37.2912. And I would submit to the court that the trial court's finding in that regard is consistent with this court's holding in Commonwealth versus Bell, is consistent with the plain language of the statute, and it's not violative of the requirements of due process as Gibson contends. And first,
how does it interact with McLeod, though?
I heard the justices' comments, and I do agree they appear irreconcilable.
Well, I think they are reconcilable.
Let me address that.
Okay.
In McLeod, this court found that it was the Commonwealth's burden to prove that there's no suitable, less restrictive alternative to commitment, and that burden cannot be placed on the respondent. However, there's still some ambiguity there on a lack of clearness, really, because at the same time the court said that it's the Commonwealth's burden, it also said, but yet the Commonwealth isn't required to put forth a specific alternative and then knock it down
exactly.
And say it's unsuitable.
Exactly.
So then, even assuming, so I think McLeod's not totally clear, but even assuming it is clear, this court availed itself of the opportunity
well,
to...
Let me just interrupt you. Isn't that consistent with Justice Mims' suggestion that it's a burden to go forward shifting?
I think McLeod could be interpreted in that manner, but Bell can't. And that's not what the court said in Bell. And like I said, even if...
So the big distinction is still one's review and one's the original proceeding. Isn't that the big distinction between Bell and McLeod?
I don't find that... I think that's a distinction without a difference. If you look at Bell is clear, and it says the burden of proof is on the respondent on conditional release.
But we're also in the framework of remaining in commitment.
And Bell, however, just to address your point there, Bell makes it clear that that's the burden on conditional release in all sexually violent predator cases. That's the language that the court used. It didn't say in annual reviews. It didn't confine it to the context of an annual review. And I think that this court's holding in Bell is consistent with the plain language of the statute. 37.2912A similarly makes no distinction whatsoever as to whether or not conditional release is considered at the trial phase or whether conditional release is considered an annual review. 37.2912A, which was interpreted by the court in Bell as putting the burden on the respondent, it says at any time the court considers the respondent's need for secure inpatient treatment pursuant to this chapter.
Counsel, there is a way to reconcile McLeod and Bell, and that is to presume an implicit presumption in Bell. And that implicit presumption would be this, that once the Commonwealth has initially met its burden, which happens at the two-phase trial, that the fact that it has met its burden continues into the future whenever the court hears this case again. and that in the future it must be the sexually violent predator who has to overcome the original proof. So the original proof in the two-phase trial was that he should be confined. The Commonwealth doesn't have to prove that all over again a year later. Rather, that proof steps forward into the annual review. And at that point, the burden does go to the sexually violent predator to say, here's some new information. I have now overcome that, and we're back to a level playing field. We're back to the point where the court has to decide one or the other. Would you agree that that is a way to reconcile the two? I'm not asking, is that your position, but would you agree that, that they can be reconciled if that's the case?
Yeah, I would think conceivably that would be a manner of reconciling it. But again, I don't think that's consistent with what the court said in Bell.
Understood. And I appreciate your candor, both in terms of your words and in terms of your facial expression.
Okay. And I admit, you know, my inexperience on this too, in that I don't know under what circumstances the court is permitted to read a rebuttable presumption into a statute where there is none. But I understand what you're saying, and conceivably that is a way. But I think it's not consistent with Bell.
Well, in the interest of reciprocal candor, we have to read this statute not only in light of what did the General Assembly say, but there's another appellate court up in Washington that tends to pay a whole lot of attention to how states interpret these statutes, and I'll just leave that as I meant.
Okay. And along the lines, too, about following up on the earlier point about the statute itself makes no distinction as to when conditional release is considered. I think if you look at the four criteria themselves, they would also suggest that the burden is on the respondent to make those findings. They're findings that are in his favor. They require the court to make affirmative findings, and the court would not be able to make such affirmative findings based upon a mere failure of the Commonwealth's proof. Just the way that they're worded, just by way of example, I won't go through them all, but just by way of example, there is significant reason to believe that the respondent, if conditionally released, would comply with the conditions specified. If the Commonwealth failed in its burden in putting forth reasons why it believes that he wouldn't comply, I'm not sure that that would enable the trial court to make the affirmative finding that there's a significant reason to believe that, yes, he will. And all of the ones, the manner in which they're worded suggests, I would submit, that it's the burden is on the respondent.
Counsel, let me interrupt you for just one second, because I asked you the same question I asked opposing counsel. On 37.2-908D, I want to ask you how that works. It says, if the court or jury finds the respondent to be a sexually violent predator, the court shall then determine that the respondent be committed or continue the trial for not less than. How does a judge, does that mean he or she can do either one? What parameters are there to that?
The trial court, by statute, at the conclusion of the trial, once there's a finding that he's a sexually violent predator, can, without any further evidence being adduced, commit the respondent on the spot. And if you read on in 37...
Or do the other thing, and how does the judge know which one to do? Is it complete discretion?
It lists nine factors that the court may consider in guiding its resolution of the mandatory four factors that are 37.2912. Things like the nature of his offenses, what his score was on actuarial instruments. This is all evidence that would have come out at trial. And the court can look and say, gosh, based on the evidence of his offenses, his just exorbitantly high risk for reoffending and other factors, he needs to be committed.
But one thing interesting, the statute said the court may consider it. Does that mean the court may not, too, and just go ahead and commit him on any reasons?
The court may consider any factor that it thinks is probative on the issue of whether commitment or conditional release is appropriate. And those are factors the court may consider. But what the court must find, even at the trial level, to commit the respondent is the four factors at 37.912. These other factors are just to guide the court and implicitly making findings on the factors at 37.2912.
I'll leave you alone now, because that's not dispositive. I just don't know the answer to that question, how the statute works. Thank you.
Now, in addition, with respect to the other issue that's raised in this appeal, is whether or not placing a burden of proof on the respondent in this matter violates his rights under the Federal Due Process Clause. I would submit to the court today that it does not. As the trial court noted, the liberty interest here is exactly the same whether you're looking at civil commitment after a dispositional hearing after the second phase of the trial, or if you're looking at civil commitment after an annual review. The liberty interest is exactly the same. It's the right to be free from civil commitment. Gibson tries to make a distinction. Well, the critical inquiry for due process purposes is the fact that at an annual review, he's already been adjudicated as unsuitable for conditional release, whereas at the trial level, he has not. But I would submit that's really a distinction without a difference. It's the same liberty interest, and it doesn't matter whether he's facing civil commitment the first time, the second time, the third time for due process purposes. I would submit that what the critical inquiry is whether or not the Commonwealth has proven by clear and convincing evidence that he's a sexually violent predator.
Let me go back on what I said. I am going to ask you another question.
Oh,
let me ask you to turn to 37.2-910, which talks about the review. And under D, the second sentence says, if the court finds the respondent remains a sexually violent predator, and we all are convinced that the Commonwealth still has a burden on that one, right?
That he remains a sexually violent predator, correct.
The court shall order that he remain in custody of the commissioner to secure inpatient hospitalization. Is that fly in the face a little bit about what you're saying, that the Commonwealth's got the burden again to prove that he's being inpatient as opposed to released? Sounds like remain has a little different wording to it.
I don't think so. I may be misunderstanding what Your Honor's saying, but I think
in other words, remain to me means what Justice Mims was saying, that the Commonwealth can rely upon that consideration from a year earlier that inpatient was the appropriate disposition.
But if you read on, it says that he remains in secure inpatient treatment or that he be conditionally released. And to determine if the respondent shall be conditionally released, you have to look again at the exact same criteria, 37.2, 912A, the same criteria that you look at regardless of when you're making the determination, whether it's an annual review, whether it's a trial, whether it's a revocation. It's the same provision of the statute. And so I think it would do violence to the statute to say that, yes, this language, which is clear and unambiguous on its face, it means one thing in an annual review context, it means another thing in a revocation, and it means another thing at the trial level. When the statute itself says at any time that conditional release is being considered, or at any time his need for secure inpatient treatment is being considered, these are the criteria that are to guide the court.
And you're basically saying that the consideration of the individual's liberty rights is the same in both instances and will be subject to the same due process.
Exactly, because the liberty interest is the same. Regardless,
so if you don't have to have a due process, if 910 doesn't have a due process issue, then your suggested approach to the 908 situation would not have a due process issue either.
It would be it's the same
right.
Liberty interest. And I think it was Justice Mollett who was talking earlier about the fact, I may be wrong, I'm sorry, about the fact that the statute allows you to be committed immediately following
yes.
a determination
yes.
of an SVP, or the court can continue the trial. And I would submit that based on the statute and in the absence of any authority cited by Gibson, there's no right to even have an opportunity to present evidence on alternatives to commitment. You can be committed on the spot based on the evidence that's already adduced at trial and without a right to even have an opportunity to put forth evidence regarding alternatives to commitment. How then can you say that it violates Gibson's due process rights to put the burden on him? If he is afforded that, to say that, yes, it was wrong to put the burden on him when he didn't even have a right to have an opportunity to put that evidence on. And lastly, the one thing Other thing I was going to mention is that it seems analogous to criminal cases where the U.S. Supreme Court has held that the Constitution permits the burden of proof to be placed on a criminal defendant on matters such as affirmative defenses or other matters that go to reduce the severity of the offense or to mitigate the punishment, as long as the Commonwealth isn't requiring the criminal defendant to negate an element of the crime. And I think here that's what's going on. An analogous situation is by asking for conditional release, Gibson is essentially asking to be relieved of the consequence of a sexually violent predator determination.
Counsel, to continue that criminal analogy one more step, would it not also be analogous to at the sentencing, within a criminal trial, you've got a two-phase trial, and the burden is on the Commonwealth not only to show guilt, but also to put on the proof that supports the sentence that it is arguing for. Subsequently, when it comes back before a tribunal on parole, when we had parole, it was not the Commonwealth's burden to argue why the person should remain. It was the individual's burden to argue why he should be released. Is this not analogous? Is the way that it's been posited by some of these questions not analogous to that?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understood your question. I'm sorry. You're saying that it would be an...
The question, actually, okay. It was somewhat rhetorical, and the time has expired.
Okay, so I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'll just withdraw.
And I would just point out, given the analogy, it would be analogous to a case where there's a mandatory minimum sentence on a defendant. And what does the Commonwealth have to put on in order for them to be sentenced to the mandatory minimum sentence? And I think the rhetorical answer would be nothing.
Thank you.
Thank you. You used all your time. Thank you. Court stands adjourned until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
All right.